That sounds good. Let's do that.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun for the very first time today with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And we're here to read the new book by Gary Renard, which is quite fascinating, about the lifetimes when Jesus and Buddha knew each other in this world. What do you think about that, Bruce?
That sounds great to me, and good morning to everyone. So, yeah, I just finished it yesterday, actually, and it's a wonderful book. I'm sure I will be reading it again very soon, but in the meantime, I'd like to, with your consent, read a bit more of it this morning.
Yeah. Absolutely, and that's great. And excuse me. This book is really being well received. A lot of people are enjoying and really having a great experience with it. So I'm just, you know, thrilled for Gary and thrilled for Art and Persa that they're getting their message through and that it really is shifting. You know, it's always been my dream since I was a little kid. I was used to have, you know, conversations very deep with Jesus. And, you know, I knew from a very early age that Jesus wanted me to help him to save the world. And it was, my heart was just full of the desire to save the world. And I just did not know how to do it. And, you know, Gary Renard, I think he got the same message, but he was given some guides to help him out. And of course, we all have guides to help us out, but you know, his guides are a little more than just, you know, whispering in his ear and telling him this is what's going on. His guides really were there in person to tell him what was going on. And you know, as you know, believe it or not, a lot of people say, "Oh, I don't believe it," and there's been a lot of skepticism about Gary and his work. And you know, I've been following Gary. I mean, he's my first connection with the Course in Miracles, and you know, his books changed my life and changed so many people's lives. Well, gave so
here.
Many people the news about what was going on and how everything worked with the Course in Miracles and why it's there and what's happening with it. And I'm telling you what. He, through his work, absolutely is saving the world, because this is absolutely what is making the people like me learn about A Course in Miracles and become the a teacher of A Course in Miracles. It's amazing to me. You know, it's become my life because of that little book, The Disappearance of the Universe, which I read in December, I think, of 2003, which completely changed the world for me and saved the world for me. Yeah. So, and speaking of which, changing and saving the world, you know, I'm writing a book, and I've been putting out bits and pieces in my new blog, which is my old blog, but I'm just revived in it. And I did send the very first chapter that I wrote. You know, it was John Mundy who encouraged me to write the book. And, you know, I had a long conversation with him on the way from the retreat center in North Carolina, Boone, North Carolina, to the Charlotte airport. And,
whoop, you still there? I think I lost you, Lynn. Hold on.
All right, you got me back?
Got you back again, okay.
I don't know what's going on with my Skype, but we'll just have to pay attention to that.
Yeah. I heard something about the going to the airport?
Going to the airport in North Carolina,
uh-huh.
And it was the first time I've really ever had any kind of in-depth conversation with John.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about the talk that John Mark Stroud had done the night before, which was very exciting about, you know, how God is really here. I mean, God's purpose is for us to be free. and to live in joy and not in fear and all that kind of stuff, and which, you know, he did a very compelling talk about it. And so I talked to John about, you know, some things in my life and how I saw that that was the purpose, was to set me free. And he was very impressed with my story, and he encouraged me to write. So I got home and I started writing, and I sent him a draft of a chapter. This was back in October. And this morning, I received an email back from him with some editing, and he said it was very good and it was very interesting. And I haven't looked at the edits yet because I'm talking to you right now, but I'm like feeling so blessed.
Oh, that's great.
That someone like John Mundy would take interest in me and would even go so far as to, you know, edit some of my writing. I'm bragging.
Well, that's really encouraging, isn't it? And I think sometimes we need those encouragements. And I think, you know, since you mentioned, you know, that we're going to be reading from Gary's fourth new and very wonderful book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. Did I get it right? Yeah. Hey, I had the cover not visible, and I think I memorized it. Okay. Anyway, I think he'd probably be the first to say that you know, it's not about personality, and it's not about the specific selves that we think we are, but it's about the awareness that we all have that is the true source of our enthusiasm, and our, you know, the anticipation of freedom that is beyond anything we can imagine, which is, you know, that, and ironically, that we're not here. And you know, it isn't the book, it's the inspiration behind the book, it's the truth behind our seeming appearance in this world that is what is truly inspiring. And I think that's what Gary does a brilliant job again, and for the fourth time in this fourth book, of conveying with his teachers that who also would be the first to say that they aren't there either any more than we are here as physical beings. So, you know, the hallucination of a Lynn or a Bruce in this world is no different than a hallucination of an Artin or a Persa in Gary's world. It's all just, you know, smoke and mirrors of this game that we made up. But the beauty of it is we can turn the tables on the ego and use the appearances that we seem to have in this world of bodies and personas and use them for forgiveness. And that, I think, is where the brilliance of you know, again, Gary's writing comes through, because and I completely resonate with what you said about you know, totally reinvigorate. Well, I happen to have picked up A Course in Miracles in the mid-80s, and I read them pretty intently for a few years, and for the most part set them aside and did sort of the spiritual buffet line, you know, metaphysical smorgasbord kind of a thing for a number of years, until 2007, when I, you know, picked up DU, Discipline of the Universe, Gary's first book, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's in there? I got to go back and reread A Course in Miracles. And so, you know, like many people, it sounds like yourself included, you know, Gary's books have been the proverbial can opener, as it's been referred to many times, for getting people back into the wisdom and the insights that really are in A Course in Miracles, and helping people get past some of the particulars around the language, the Shakespearean iambic pentameter blank verse, and the masculine pronouns, and you know, just the style of the writing, which is very much influenced by Helen's preferences and interests, and which, you know, as Artin and Persa explain, you know, really makes this a timeless work that will carry on, you know, many millennia, because the writing is so timeless. But for some people, again, which is also usually a good place to look at our resistance, usually further along in the course study, and to why we use specific forms as a mechanism for our resistance. It's really because we're all to one degree or another afraid of that perfect love that the course represents. And again, I think it's really important to keep in mind that it really is a representation of a decision in the mind. That these wonderful books, Gary's books, A Course in Miracles, all of Ken's writing and so many other things that are inspired, before we, our culture and civilization, even as we think of it on this planet, was around, there would have been inspired works and inspired teachers, and it's because there's an inspiration within everyone that we all have and share, and the forms that these take that appear to be the special gifts, so to speak, really are just reflections of a decision in our mind to listen to those gifts and to those beacons of light within ourselves that is really our self, capital S, calling to our decision-making mind to choose again, as the Course puts it. So anyway, with that.
Absolutely. And just to mention something that is pretty important to me, that has to do with Gary Renard, The Disappearance of the Universe, Art and Impersa. There's a lot of skepticism on a lot of people's part about the true and reality of all of these happenings and these beings and these, ascended masters and, how do they, and why would they have appeared here in the world to this, kind of clueless guy and although, I don't think Gary was ever a clueless guy. I think that's kind of a priest because I think that, he has been, very, 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 he was working very hard. I mean, he was meditating a lot of hard work on himself. But Jesus says to us, this is something a lot of people just have not seen or do not know. When he, and I don't have it here online, but I can look it up. He says, and the Jesus says to us in the Course that there are many teachers who are not in form, who appear to us at certain times in form. They materialize a body. It's in the clarification of terms under the description of Jesus the Christ or the discussion of Jesus and the Christ. And the whole, let's see, let me find it. Here's my old Course in Miracles book. Discussion is about, don't imagine. Oh wait, is this one? Okay, people do appear. They are not in form. They come into form to talk to people and to give us, teachings or help or whatever. And because my eyes are all blurry this morning, I can't read it either.
As you're looking for that, I'll just comment on that, which your comments inspired me to recall, another quote that's about hallucinations. And I think that somewhere in the Course is that, this world is a hallucination merely, and albeit a persistent one or something like that. And it kind of reminded me of, a principle from modern physics that I learned, a couple decades ago when my wife and I had a group called New Frontiers of the Gold Country in Northern California. We had a speaker named Robin McWane, who had been studying quantum physics, and she gave a wonderful little, layman's cook's tour of some of the interesting highlights of modern physics discoveries in the last years and some of the more metaphysical implications of that, even though it was really more just about some of the bizarre physics that, the metaphysics was pretty obvious, I think, to a lot of people in the audience. And one of them was the Planck time constant. There's a time constant and a space constant, both of which are astronomically small numbers. The Planck space constant, I think, is like 10 to the minus 33rd centimeters, which is a pretty tiny, and if you were to take an electron microscope, it'd be a whole lot smaller than anything that can resolve, by lots of orders of magnitude. So it's like, you know, there's this quantization of space that's just, it's a you know, a holographic idea that this is made up. And then the quantum time, the Planck time constant is like something along the order of 10 to the minus 44 seconds, which is an incredibly, you know, you think of a millisecond, you know, as a thousandth of a second, a microsecond is a millionth of a second, a nanosecond is 10 to the minus 9. Well, now imagine, you know, 10 with 33 zeros, you know, 10 to the minus 33. That's a really, really fast thing. But
that's something you can't imagine.
It's boggling. I mean, we can imagine the number 33, but 33 zeros in front of the decimal point, you know, that's a pretty fine granularity of time, just as the space constant, or 10 to the minus 44 and the time constant 33 for the space, I believe, if I get those, you know, ballpark figures right. But what that says, I think the cool take-home lesson of that is that we're experiencing a stroboscopic universe. And the way she put it in her, Robin McWane in her talk, was that, and I think this is actually what some of the modern physics is suggesting, is that the universe literally disappears, winks out of existence, and reappears full blown, in a sort of a stroboscopic manner. It's just like it's pulsing.
Yes.
10 to the 44th times per second.
Yes.
And if you just kind of let that sink in a minute, it's like, wow. I mean, just like when you go to a movie or you watch TV or your computer, you know, a video on your computer, you know, 30 frames per second, or 60 on, you know, roughly on television, you know, is fast enough that we don't even notice the flicker. We just kind of blend it all together because of the you know, the physiology of the eye and the nervous system and the, you know, all that kind of stuff in the retina. So we for all intents and purposes, it just seems like one continuous thing. But the world is discontinuous. It's basically this discrete little bunches of pulses that is a hologram of such enormous proportions on both ends of the time and space spectrum that we're clueless. We're like Truman in the Truman Show without a clue that this is an amazingly elaborate hoax that is not being put on by something outside of ourselves. It's being put on by this ego mind that believes that it has created some cosmic crime that is so heinous and so, you know, horrifically awful and you know, unimaginably bad. Mm-hmm. Because, and that's the word that the only ego can relate to, is that we needed to somehow, in order to escape from this guilt, which is mostly unconscious, we needed to make up a whole universe. And so we, you know, because our minds are so powerful, as the Course reminds us, we were able to do this and make up this stroboscopic, holographic universe, as Ken Wapnick puts it, a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. And but we've done it in a way that is imperceptible to our senses, so that we buy into it. I mean, we're like an audience in a magic show, and we don't notice the sleight of hand because of, you know, the principle of distraction. We're so distracted by, you know, the ooh shiny stuff in the world that we think is going to help us, you know, feel at peace. We forget that that's not where the problem is. The problem is the decision in the mind to have chosen an insane teacher and, you know, the maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem. The non-existent problem is the universe, and the maladaptive solution is the decision in the mind, you know, the inner secret of you know, the inner shield of oblivion that we made up to hide the unconscious guilt we think we attempt, anyway, to hide in the world, but it never happened. And we don't know that the unconscious guilt is unfounded until we look at it. So, anyway, that's sort of another little mini review.
Well, yeah.
Some things that helped me.
It's real clear to think about because that flickering of the illusion, even though it's flickering so fast that you can't see it, is the same thing that happens with a projector.
Exactly.
It's the thing. I mean, exactly. We're given so many illustrations of, you know, if you blink your eyes, blink, blink, boom, 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 really, really fast. Things appear and disappear, appear and disappear, appear and disappear. That really is what's happening. Is it is only in existence as when we think about it. It's only here when I am observing it. It doesn't exist unless I am observing it. And the reason it doesn't exist unless I'm observing it is because I'm projecting it. You know.
Yeah, and the projector is a great metaphor too. I was just thinking probably some of the younger people might be hearing this might not have had the experience of being in a school classroom where a projector was, you know, people. I remember like in fourth grade, you know, our fourth grade teacher would play movies. We had a substitute teacher about half the year because our regular teacher went out on pregnancy leave, and so because she had even less control of us unruly kids, she would entertain us frequently by showing movies and find the most interesting one she could, and then she'd run them backwards because that was really hilarious, and we got to watch people, you know, pulling grapes out of their mouth and attaching them to stems, and then the cluster of grapes would then be reattached to the vine as they would walk backwards through the vineyards, and you know, so we had a blast in it. But anyway, but when the movie slowed down, you know, the old 35mm films. And, when the projector would malfunction, you would see the individual frames flickering, but it usually happens at a rate fast enough that we don't notice it, or, you know, our minds kind of blend it all together, even though that you can detect the electromagnetic, electrochemical pulses in the retina and the nervous system, if you were to measure it that way. But, you know, our mind just kind of averages it all out and says it's just one continuous thing. And the same thing is true with this 10 to the 44th times per second stroboscopic hologram that we're experiencing. And we just think, oh, this is the real deal. I mean, how could this not be reality? Well, of course, Miracle says, no, this is just a hallucination of, you know, seemingly enormous proportions. But it also reminds us in a very encouraging sense that and the truth of it, the fact that we are beyond space and time. What we are is so much bigger than that illusion that it dwarfs that illusion to nothingness, because it really is in truth nothing. Anything that doesn't last eternally is nothing. So how's that for a preface, for Gary's preface?
I like it. I like it a lot. And I will find that, I mean, I know it's it is the clarification of terms, or in the thing about Jesus and the Christ.
Yeah.
Where he talks about that, he was a man who saw the face of Christ, and everyone
right.
Says this all the time. But that that he was really not there. He actually I think that's what's so cool about it, is that he talks about it in terms of I wasn't really there. I mean, I only appeared when it was necessary for, you know, whatever to be, and not, you know, he took on that form. That's what's so cool about it. He explains it really clearly, and again, I had it, and then I went and looked at something else while you were talking.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's in the, like, 29 section of the manual. That's
okay.
As far as it goes there.
Okay.
Because I think it's, anyway.
Well, your comments remind me of another quote that I find really helful, too, that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles had a video streaming class about not too long ago, a few months ago, and it was, the title of which was a quote from the Course, and also Gary has put it in this most recent book somewhere, I believe, the way to find joy in a joyless place is to realize that you're not there. And I think it's not saying that, you know, we don't appear to be in the world. It's just saying that our true reality is not in physical form, and it couldn't ever possibly be, because physicality, even according to physics, is, a made up mental concept.
Exactly. So, let's see.
Although a lot of physicists wouldn't phrase it that way. They probably would risk losing their tenure to express it in quite those terms.
Exactly, because it's not quite scientific. But it's true. And this is how he describes it. And I'm just going to read this paragraph, which you're all familiar with because I say it all the time. Because this is, to me, the crux of this entire Course in Miracles. You know, this is what he wants us to do, what he did. And it says, the name of Jesus is the name of one who was a man, but saw the face of Christ and all his brothers and remembered God. So he became identified with Christ, a man no longer. You know, his entire identity was of the Christ, not of a man, not as a physical body. The man no longer, but at one with God. The man was an illusion, for he seemed to be a separate being walking by himself within a body that appeared to hold his self from self, as all illusions do. Yet who can save unless he sees illusions and then identifies them as what they are? Jesus remains a savior because he saw the false without accepting it as true. And Christ needed his form that he might appear to men and save them from their own illusion. So Christ came, he identified with the Christ, but he continued with the illusion of form so that he could continue to connect with us, to tell us and to show us. And to be an example in all that. But in his complete identification with the Christ, the perfect Son of God, his one creation and his happiness forever like himself and one with him, Jesus became all that what all of you must be. And that's what he's saying. We're here to become the Christ. He led the way for you to follow him. He leads you back to God because he saw the road before him and he followed it. He made a clear distinction, still obscure to you, between the false and true. He offered you a final demonstration that it is impossible to kill God's Son, nor can his life in any way be changed by sin and evil, malice, fear, or death. And therefore all your sins have been forgiven, because they carried no effects at all, and so they were but dreams. Arise with him who showed you this. Arise with him who showed you this, because you owe him this.
Oops. Can you still hear me? I think I just lost the audio again. That's Adlin.
There we go. Gotcha back. Okay, so you owe it to him. This is where I was at, okay? I was at, you owe him this. He shared your dreams that they might be dispelled and shares them all to be at one with you. So, you know, we're picking up this blue book. Did you pick up this blue book and said, oh, now I'm going to find out what I owed and now I'm going to fulfill my obligation? Was that...
Well, I would clarify that in the sense of owing, it's not a debt in a sense of a burden. It's really, if you can even use the word debt, it's a debt of gratitude, and it's to ourselves, to our capitalist selves. Because if we owe this quote debt, it's really basically saying almost like workbook lesson 182 is we owe it to the child within ourselves, the Christ child, if you will, that is a symbol of the part of us that really, truly, deeply, madly wants to go. Well, not madly, but truly and deeply wants to go home. and I think that's why, you know, it does feel like something that it's almost like a debt we're repaying, but in a sense, there's no negativity to that debt. It's basically just like, oh wow, we've been given this gift, and it's out of a feeling of complete ease and peace and generosity that we give this to ourselves and to each other, and it's really the release from obligation and from burden that is accomplished by and certainly the unconscious guilt by choosing that thought system and being consistently more and more vigilant only for the atonement, which is to see that separation never happened and to forgive ourselves using the quantum forgiveness that Gary's books eloquently detail, that really does undo that unconscious guilt. And I think that is a wonderful gift that we give everyone, because there's no one out there.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if we give to ourselves. So this paragraph, I'm just going to read this next couple paragraphs of this, because okay. This is really what gave me the understanding of what happens. And there is another quote in the book, which I'll find and send to you, that really makes it very clear. It says, "Is he the Christ? Oh, yes, along with you." Mm-hmm. "His little life on earth was not enough to teach the mighty lesson that he learned for all of you. He will remain with you to lead you from the hell you made to God. And when you join your will with his, your sight will be his vision. For the eyes of Christ are shared. Walking with him is just as natural as walking with a brother whom you knew since you were born. For such indeed he is. Some bitter idols have been made of him who would be only brother to the world. Forgive him your illusions, and behold how dear a brother he would be to you. For he will set your mind at rest at last and carry it with you unto God." So he's saying when you hook up with your brother and forgive your brother and see how dear your brother is, your brother Christ, he is the same. Jesus is the same as every other brother. And when we have our minds set free by that knowing that we are not separate and we are all the same, not even Jesus is above us, that he is our equal brother and we are the same thing as he is. When we begin to really know that, then it shifts our perception. And by shifting our perception, because this is an illusion, the entire illusion is changed because you're seeing it for what it is. So then this last paragraph is really the kicker here. "Is he God's only helper? No, indeed. For Christ takes many forms with different names until their oneness can be recognized." Now you... This is getting a little annoying. Good thing I'm doing the recording. Anyway, so Christ will appear to us in many forms, and we recognize Jesus. Jesus is for you the bearer of Christ's single message of the love of God. You need no other. It is possible to read his words and benefit from them without accepting them into your life, yet he would help you a little more if you would share your pains and joys with him and leave them both to find the peace of God. Yet still it is his lesson most of all that he would have you learn, and it is this. There is no death because the Son of God is like his Father. Nothing you can do can change eternal love. Forget your dreams of sin and guilt and come with me instead to share the resurrection of God's Son and bring with you all those whom he has sent to you to care for as I care for you. So it sounds to me like he's saying, yeah, you're going to do this and you're going to come and bring yourself and you're going to bring everyone who's been sent to you, everyone who's come to you, whether it's come to your mind, whether it's come into your physical person, whether it's somebody that you met acquaintance on the street, you know, all of it. They're all me, they're all in me, and they're all coming with me back home to my reality. That wasn't the point I wanted to make, but the point I wanted to make was that the Christ comes to us in many forms. And so just relating the Christ is in Jesus or the Christ is in a certain person or something, you know, the Christ comes, our truth comes. And for Gary, it was his truth who came to see him. It was the reality, the Christ that came to see him. And the Christ came to see him in the form of actually himself from another part of the dream, from a part of the dream where that self recognized the truth of what it was and came back to the self that appeared, or the person that appeared here in this section of the dream, and related to himself the truth of what he was. And it really all happened within the mind of Gary Renard, even though, you know, he saw it as physical persons, just as he sees this as a physical world, just as I see this as a physical world. This is how we're programmed to see, because this is all we know. If he had known that there was, that he was an eternal being, and that he had the ability to do all these things, he wouldn't have needed to come to see himself and tell himself, hey, look what you got, look what's going on. I just think it's very cool and very ironic, because you know it's all happening in an illusion. Mm-hmm. So Jesus and Buddha, you know, they're, it's just chapters of the book. They showed up together in, you know, we can read the book and learn lessons.
Yeah, and cool. And I think it's a good point to remind ourselves and everyone that, you know, the appearances that we have as bodies, you know, and the things, the people that are in our lives are not only coming to us, but even more importantly, they're coming from us. And so as we, you know, and as Gary explains, not only in his writings, but also in the Course, that, you know, these appearances, whether they appear to be, you know, friendly or not, is depending on our choice of thought system. And I think his books do a wonderful job of explaining the context of how his visitors, Artin and Persa, came to him and what the purpose of that was and how, you know, and they reiterate very beautifully how the form is not important. You know, if some people are ready for an ascended master, appearance to appear in front of the appearance of their own bodies so that their mind can get it, that may be what they're ready for. In someone else, you know, from certainly a lot more people, and myself included, the appearance of, you know, four books from this guy that I in my mind I call Gary Renard, and who is talking about other people that I believe existed, including the person that's reading the book called Bruce, and other people written about called Helen and Bill and Ken and Judy and the Bruces and the Lynns and everyone else in the world. These are all just symbols, and they're expressions of ideas, and we sometimes forget that. And I think that's why these books are so helpful, to using the books themselves to remind us. So should we read a little bit more?
Sure. Why don't you start?
Let's okay.
Hope your connection hangs in there.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
weather.
I don't know what's going on, but we'll see if we can troubleshoot it if it continues.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So anyway, I'll read from the 18th page of the introduction, which is XVII in Renard's fourth new book. And just to back up a paragraph from where we left off last week, he says, "The world of God cannot be seen with the body's eyes, except once in a while in temporary symbols." Well, how appropriate. We're just talking about symbols. "Because the body represents a limit on awareness. However, your perfect oneness with your source can be experienced. Even while you appear to be here in a body, it's possible to experience the real you. And spiritual experience is very important. In fact, it's the only thing that will ever make you happy. Words won't do it. My words won't do it. As the Course says, words are but symbols of symbols. They are thus twice removed from reality. And when you think of it, how is a symbol of a symbol ever going to make you happy? How is it ever going to make you feel full, whole, complete, and satisfied?" That's also a question any dieter can ask themselves, or binge participant in whatever, right?
Exactly. Do me a favor. What was the first three words of that first sentence you read? I lost my place on my Kindle, so.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I have regular page numbers because I have a big font.
Okay, it's how is it ever going to make you feel full, whole, complete, and satisfied?
All right. I
will. And then the conclusion of that backing up paragraph is, even a description of the reality of the world of God won't do that. It's still just words. But an experience of reality, an experience of what you really are and where you really are, which is alluding to the out of space and time dream, will make you happy because it is full and whole and complete and satisfying.
Yeah. And I found it. That's one great thing about something like a Kindle. You have a search function and it's, yeah. I just look for the word satisfied.
And it
brought it right up for me. So
great.
That's very cool. This whole idea of, first, what took for me, and I'm a meditator. I love to meditate, and I would do any kind of meditation. People come up, try this meditation, try that meditation. I did TM. I studied with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, which that whole thing with Trungpa was all about meditation. So I'm like really into meditating and looking at my thoughts, and looking at the world, and looking at what is, and just seeing this reality of what is, and this is really what you have to come to this conclusion at some point, that what is completely separate from our description of it. You can describe a dog. You can say this is a dog, and he's friendly, and he's cute, and he's fluffy, and he's stinky, and he's this. And you can have all these thoughts about the dog, but you don't know the dog. Mm-hmm. Those thoughts are not the dog.
Right. It's a very Platonic concept.
Yes.
Plato said, that a chair isn't the reality, it's the idea of a chair that's more real, and that Platonic ideal is talked about later in the book too, and how we need to also go beyond that as well.
Exactly. So when we hear these words, for me, I contemplate these words, I meditate on these words, not because I see that there's something that I'm going to learn from the word. I want to know, where did that word come from? What is the source of that thing? Not that, God made it up, or that, humans made it up and they decided this. Not the actual source, the dog. I want to know the dog. And that is a completely different thing than knowing the description or having a picture of the dog. So that's when we hear these words, when I see this in a lot of spiritual and new age, and in fact, I think Rupert Spira I was listening to, and he said that he went to Cambridge or something, and there was a lecturer, and this guy was a philosopher, a lecturer on philosophy, and he was going to talk about, what is the world or something. And so Rupert said, well, this ought to be good. So so he went to this lecture, and I'm probably just destroying this entire school.
Whoop, just lost you again. Oh, man. What's going on here?
The lecturer is standing up there talking this, really esoteric philosophical thing. And after the lecture, Rupert Spira went up to him and he said, well, that's really interesting that you expressed and explained everything about what, reality is. What is your experience of reality? Is what you described your actual experience? And the guy was like, what are you talking about? So Rupert started talking to him about reality, and the guy was like, well, no, you can't know that. That's not something that can be known. That's, you're talking about, fantasy. He could not see beyond his words and descriptions and philosophies about reality. He couldn't sense the truth beyond the words. So his discussion was completely intellectual and had nothing to do with the like Muji would tell you about reality, or A Course in Miracles would tell you about reality. It was completely, it had no depth. And you know, so this whole idea of, you know, what are the words and compared to the experience of reality, that experience, as he said, Gary says right here, is what you really are and where you really are. And it will make you happy because it is full. It is whole. It is complete. It is satisfying. We will never stop searching until we're satisfied. And that's... Hey, Bruce,
uh-huh.
Why don't you, can you put your number in the chat box here, your phone number, and I can call you on the phone?
Sure. The audio connection is not going to be as good, but we can try it. Yeah, this is like fifth or sixth time it's dropped out.
So, right, yeah.
Sure.
And
sure.
And you're missing my brilliant talk, so I need
Well, now we get to the real important factor.
It's the real important thing. Yeah, just type your message.
I did.
Excuse me. Now I'm going to cough my head off.
It's in the chat window there.
Okay, there we go. Okay. So I'll hang on with you until, or unless and until it drops. And now this is a threat, Skype. Do you see this? Do you see this? We're going to
maybe leave. Maybe it's just a fluke for this morning. We've got less than half an hour, or not much more than half an hour, so maybe it'll hang in there.
Okay.
But you got the phone number as a backup.
I got the phone number as a backup.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to let you finish reading, because you were just getting ready to read the paragraph that starts with the Gnostics.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. I'll do that then.
Okay.
Okay, so this is on page 19 of the Roman numeral 19 of the introduction, the author's note, basically, from Gary Renard's new fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, History of Mighty Companions. So he's talking about what's going to really make us happy is an experience of that perfect oneness. And then, so just to back up, to kind of quickly summarize the previous paragraph. So it goes on, he continues, the Gnostics refer to this direct experience of God as gnosis, and that's G-N-O-S-I-S, which means knowledge. But it doesn't mean intellectual knowledge or information. When the Course uses the word knowledge, it often uses a capital K because, like the word gnosis, it isn't referring to direct, it is referring to direct experience or knowledge of God. So, and I think that's really, again, you know, in a sense it's kind of beyond the scope of the Course, because that's really talking about what in Ken Wapnick's chart that's probably famous to some Course students, where it's sort of above the line, where the decision maker is the middle dot, at the bottom center of
the blue dot.
The blue dot is, yes, which he says was locked in a vault for safekeeping in one of his talks, jokingly. But yeah, he has sort of this chart of everything above that line is truth with a capital T, that is really sort of unknowable in this world, but we can get glimpses of it and reflections of it. And I think that's why, you know, the Course says it doesn't aim at teaching the meaning of love, because that's beyond teaching, but it does aim at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is our true inheritance. And that is basically how Gary's books, I think, have opened up tremendously, a whole range and demographic of people who might not have otherwise looked at A Course in Miracles or picked it up again, in my case, because it reminds us that the process of getting there is through forgiveness. And that, you know, I that was one of the things that was one of my aha moments in 2007, over a decade ago, when I picked up Gary's first book, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's all about forgiveness. And then I went through read through the Course again several times. I kind of lost track since then, but how many, but It's like, you know, everywhere you look, it's about forgiveness. And it comes at it from using different words in places, but it really keeps coming back to, you know, the forgiveness and salvation and atonement and the undoing of the ego. You know, they're all somewhat synonymous for that process of looking at the insane belief that, you know, we could have possibly made up a world of separation, not just physically, but in our minds, and that there's no basis. It's totally unfounded for the unconscious guilt that we have. And that's why the process of consistent vigilance in our minds that Gary's writing and of course all of Ken's and the course, comes at, us with is this wonderful, persistent inspiration that comes out from all these different angles that remind us that we really can, with practice, become more vigilant and allow that inspiration to come through. And I found reading this book over the last week and a few days, that it's been here about a week and a half, since it arrived on my doorstep, it's like, wow, there really is, you know, it's just a reinvigoration and a rejuvenation of the inspiration behind A Course in Miracles. And you realize, you know, it really is something that we can all do and will all do. And why just kind of futz around with egos, you know, kind of mixed magnet stuff, you know? Why should we deprive ourselves of the true profound gifts of the peace that's beyond understanding when it's just a decision in our mind to consistently practice this forgiveness classroom, right?
Is that just the most insane thing? Because what do you think? You think it's hard? You think it's hard? You know, that's what I said the whole time. Oh, but it's so hard to watch my thoughts. It's so hard to make sure that I'm not, you know, condemning people. It's so easy to fall into, you know, the world and all the things that they're doing. And, you know, even look now, you can look on, you know, anywhere on the news, on Facebook, on, that's the only places I look, actually, the news and Facebook. And then I just hang out here and gather when people talk about God. But, but I see, you know, these terrible things, and it's so easy to say, oh man, that shouldn't be happening. It's really bad. And, you know, and just to move into judgment, it seems so easy because there's consensus. Other people support you. If you say, I hate this guy because of what he's doing, you'll have, you know, 50,000 people that'll say, yes, me too. And then you'll also have 50 or 48 or 37,000 people, whatever that, you know, is, saying, oh, you know, he's great. But, the world supports you in this heresy. The world supports you in it. And actually it makes it seem simple and easy. But the reality is, and this is what came to me after I got into some very, very deep stillness, the reality is that the effort that it takes to look and assess and judge and condemn is the thing that totally saps my life, my energy, my heart, my physical being. You know, Jesus told Helen, the reason that you perceive yourself as being tired is because you're wearing yourself out with these judgments.
The strain of constant judgment is virtually intolerable, I think it says, something
exactly.
Pretty close to that.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's what it is. When you are siding with the world and looking at the world and trying to find proof that the world is true and proof that the world is right, you are basically constantly judging, and it is a strain. It's so difficult. It's so hard, and it's so painful because, you know, all it is attack, which is so opposite of our nature. That it is, that's what's making us old. That's what's making us sick. That's what's killing us, is this constant attack. And so how can you ever perceive that it's easier to constantly attack than it is to just let things be?
Practice, isn't it? Because the more we practice looking at our minds without judgment, the easier it becomes. Just like riding a bicycle, you know, the first time or two, or maybe more than that for some people, you know, it's very awkward, and it takes a lot of focus and concentration. But that's because, you know, our minds are not disciplined. And now, you know, if you haven't ridden one for 30 years, you know, if you hop on a bike, if you've done it for, you know, enough times, it'd probably just be second nature and you just hop right on and get off and go. But I think it's only because we've practiced, through countless lifetimes investing in this egoic thought system that seems easier, but it's actually much more draining and challenging. And the real ease, the true ease comes from the opposite thought system that has no opposite. How's that for a conundrum? Because, well, it's really reminding us that what we really are has no opposite. But essentially, you know, the real, you know, our right mind, as the Course puts it, is really just the collection of thoughts that undo the belief that separation was possible. And I was just thinking that, you know, you said a word that kind of reminded me that we have to get past the illusion in order to truly forgive. We have to see it as illusion and as unreal for the forgiveness to work. And that way we're sort of, you know, shaving off the illusion in our mind if it's just a heresy, right?
Exactly. It's just a heresy. And it's a definition. Again, we're going to go back to those words and look at what those words mean to you of anything. Just look at the words that come to you. You know, I think I was really onto something when I hooked up with Marshall Rosenberg in the nonviolent communication, because when I began to see the inherent violence in the language, uh-huh, and how it's actually set up to judge, to condemn, to protect and defend, it's astonishing, actually, mm-hmm, when you see the depth of which our language is made to ensure that we continue to engage in the illusion.
Yep.
So
yeah, his work can be a wonderful adjunct to looking at.
When I began to see how powerful those words were, and the fact that always just kept coming back to me, and you know, from being in this room initially, and having, you know, someone in this room who was in the PAL talk in ACIM Gather, who was constantly attacking or.
Oops. Oh. All right. Let's try this again.
All right, I got you back. I was just gonna try to call you, but okay. Yeah. But anyway, as I was going on about how the language is used to formulate the attack, to define the problem, to decide, to plan for the attack, and to formulate the attack. That's what our language is actually made for. And when it's, you know, we're saying it's to help us to communicate, but really it's to help us to plan our defenses. And I know that probably just sounds wacky as hell, but, you know, I've looked at it a lot and I see how it works. You're either using it to attack or you're using it to love. And they're two very, very different thought systems. Surprise. But anyway, where I was trying to go with this before our hour is up is that this is where you have to start if you really want to look at your judgments, and you can't let them go until you look at them, until you look at what is this, and really ask yourself, why am I choosing this instead of this? Why am I choosing to attack rather than to love? You know, Charles Manson died. He'd been in prison for his entire life since the, big massacre and all the, you know, terrible occurrences, which basically happens every day now. The crap that's happening in the world now, today, is so much more horrific than anything Charles Manson ever imagined that it's laughable to me as to why we've defined him as the ultimate evil, and yet completely forget about everything else that's happening in the world, or, you know, brush it off as being not as bad. Why? Because of concepts and words. And so here was a band who, you know, had, you know, obviously, you know, he was here for that purpose, you know, for me to show me, because I knew Charles Manson. I didn't know him personally. You know, I got picked up hitchhiking by someone who I believe was from his, you know, group at one time, and was offered to go to their place and, you know, eat dinner and whatever. And fortunately for me, I said, no, I got someone else. I got to go. And asked them to let me off the truck. But I read the book, brilliant book by Vincent Bugliosi, called Helter Skelter. And that was back in the early 80s I read that book. And when I read that book, and this is going to sound really twisted, you're going to go, Lynn, are you nuts? When I read that book and I read about Charles Manson and what he did and what he said that was not related to the crimes, but just in general, him as a teacher and as a guru and as a you know, father of a little community, he had a lot of truth in the things that he was saying and teaching. And when I read that stuff, I'm like, you know what? This guy is like close to being enlightened. He could just be like one step from being enlightened. And that may sound really goofy, but I bet you I could reread that book today and say the same thing and even more, because I know more now about the truth and of reality, or so I think. All right. I got you back. That was really weird. I guess Charles Manson just blew the Skype out.
the only thing I was going to comment on that, and before the audio cut out again, and I had to recall via Skype, is that, and this is something that is brought out in Gary's book toward the end. I forget exactly where, but they're talking about, you know, the Hitlers and the insane people of the world. Well, we're all insane here. It's just the amount of time that we spend in that thought system that seems to vary. But everybody has, and I love how Ken Wapnick continues to you know, reiterate this every time I listen to one of his audios or whatever, that, you know, we really have three aspects of our mind. We have a totally 100% insane thought system that we call ego. We have a 100% sane thought system that is completely polarized in every conceivable way, that we can call Holy Spirit or the right mind or Jesus of A Course in Miracles. It's going to be a symbol for that. I call it, you know, our inner kindness teacher. And we have a decision-making faculty that constantly, maybe it's 10 to the 44th times per second, but, you know, it's we have a lot of opportunities every moment to choose between these two thought systems, and that's all we're doing. And so the cumulative amount of time we spend in those thought systems over time really kind of determines the experience of our life. And once we get over the 50% point, I think, like you were talking about earlier, Lynn, it becomes easier and easier to say, you know, it is actually easier in truth to identify with the reality of our being, because that requires no defense, that requires no justification, and no, you know, explanation and excuses of, well, I chose this because, you know, all the shoulda, coulda, wouldas and oughtas, and, you know, the whole thought system of guilt just becomes are seen as the tremendous burden that it is when we choose the sanity instead of the insanity. But everybody, including the Mansons and the Hitlers and any politician or any public figure, whether they're involved in a sexual assault abuse scandal in the news currently or the politicians and public figures and non-public figures going back to the beginning of what we think of as time, you know, that we all have these, you know, three aspects, the sane, the insane thought systems and the choice between them moment to moment, don't we?
Exactly, we do. And to finish that story that I was just saying about the Charles Manson thing, if I would have, I thought about this so much later, after this, especially after I read that book, I could very easily have just said yes and went to their house and ate with them and listened to this person talk. And I may have been, you know, I can't imagine I would have ever killed anybody, but I certainly may have been coerced to do a lot of other stuff because I was young and that stuff was interesting, but not that stuff, but
well, I'm glad you didn't, because now we're having this conversation because
exactly. See, the choice you had to make. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and read the next paragraph. We are reading from the introduction to the new Gary Renard book, When the Lifetimes in Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, and the History of My Companions. Okay, so he's talking about knowledge or gnosis, which is the knowledge of God. How does one get to this experience which blows away anything this world has to offer? This is accomplished by undoing your ego. As ACIM succinctly puts it, salvation is undoing. And that's a brilliant approach, because if you could really do that, you could completely undo the false you. Then eventually the real you would be all that's left, and you don't have to do anything about the real you. The real you is already perfect. It's already exactly the same as its source. And that's what I was talking about. When you stop thinking with that false mind where you're believing everything that comes to you and you're defining the words to make everything appear to be attack, when you stop that attack and stop that judgment, and just completely just stop, then what the thing that's left is the one who can act like the real, that is the real you. The only thing that's left is the open and loving Holy Son of God, who has no judgments, because he has no basis on which to judge. He sees everything as being the light of God, whole and perfect, innocent. So there's nothing to judge other than you are God's son, complete and whole and innocent. You know, that's it. So that's all that's left. You don't have to do anything about the real you. The real you is already perfect. It's already the same as its source. In order to experience that perfection, what you have to do is to remove the ego within your unconscious mind, the walls of separation that block your experience of this perfection. And here's another thing, not to keep interrupting Gary, but the removing the ego. This is what people people think you got to make friends with the ego. You have to be helpful to the ego. You have to convince the ego to go away. You just have to stop believing it. It's not going to be butt hurt and run off crying. All right, this is getting to be ridiculous. Anyway, but we're almost done.
But this world is ridiculous, so we can afford to laugh at it, right?
Exactly. So anyway, what I was saying is, you know, we're not here to make friends with the ego. We're not here to cajole the ego or make the ego, you know, into a happy ego so that it'll cooperate with us. We're not here to try to seduce the ego or coerce the ego or any of that kind of stuff. We're here to forget about the ego and stop listening to its insanity and stop believing what it's saying. So when we stop believing what the ego is telling us, then we can hear the truth about what's really here. Mm-hmm. So in order to experience that perfection, what you have to do is remove the ego within your unconscious mind, the walls of separation that block your experience of this perfection. The Course takes you through a process that undoes the false you that incorrectly believes it has taken on an individual and personal identity, a separate existence from God. As we'll see in this book, that's not something you can do on your own. So that's it. You can't, if you could do it on your own, you'd have done it already.
Right. And eventually we will see that, that we really do have the help we need, regardless of the form it seems to take, that's always within us, but appears to be outside of us sometimes. And sometimes it's in the form of a conversation like we're having right now, or a teacher, or a book, or, like Gary's book that we're reading from, or whatever. But it really is just a symbolic emissary of an aspect of our awareness that we took with us into the dream. So essentially we begin to realize that everyone, it becomes our savior, if you will. It becomes the emissary for the truth, because we realize everyone is either expressing love or they're expressing a call for love. And seen rightly, from the right mind, as of course would put it, we can see everything as a blessing and afford to be grateful, since this is Thanksgiving weekend. Tie a little bit of gratitude in here, the non-dual, non-polarizing variety of gratitude. And we can afford to be grateful for everyone, everything from that perspective, because everyone is serving up and dishing up the contents of our unconscious mind that we would not see otherwise. And I keep coming back to Ken's brilliant phrase, extrapolating on the work of Freud, it's the royal road to the unconscious that the dreams of this world represent. And that we wouldn't be able to look at the contents of our mind and the unconscious guilt there if it weren't for all the mathematically perfect experiences that seem to come to us that are really coming from us, that give us an opportunity to look at the contents of our mind and forgive ourselves. And that's all we're doing, is forgiving ourselves for a silly made-up idea that is an unfounded unconscious realm of guilt, sin, fear, death, destruction, devastation, and sin, craziness, insanity, right?
Exactly. And it's because we identify with that illusion that it becomes something that we need to protect. This is why we don't want to let it go. We don't want to look at it. If you look at an illusion and see that it's an illusion, you don't believe it anymore. Mm-hmm. If you watch a magician or street magician or whatever, you may be, if you see and know how they do it, then they can never fool you again with it.
Right.
And this is what it is with this illusion. If you can see that it's an illusion, and there are so many clues that are here. When I see the patterns that just repeat, it's like the same thing happening over and over and over. It's just a different personality or a different way it looks or whatever, but it's like a formula. And when I began to see that everything around that we're experiencing is formulaic, it's not like we're inventing a new reality every moment. We're seeing the same pattern projected, like going to a Western movie or going to, an action movie, you're going to see the same thing projected over and over and over. And when you begin to see that it's just patterns and it's not, there is no effect, the actors still go home after the movie and, have their after cast party or whatever, we have so many clues that it's not real, and yet we want so much to buy into it. Yeah. So how do we let go of that? How do we get to where we can see every time how we're being fooled?
Exactly. When we realize we're in the theater of our mind, we just have to grab a chair next to Jesus and sit calm in the audience and realize it's just a sitcom in our mind, right?
Yes.
How's that? Shall I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Gary continues, this raises another question. How do you play your part in undoing the ego? This is achieved through a certain kind of forgiveness, but not the kind of forgiveness that most people in the world think of, if they think of forgiveness at all. The traditional form of forgiveness makes the illusory world real in your mind, thus keeping it and the ego intact in your mind. But true forgiveness does not make the illusory world real and does not keep it and the ego intact. And I'll just add a little comment here. I think it's a common thing to think of it. We need to destroy or you know, fight the ego, but I don't think that's what's being talked about here at all in Gary's books or in the course. It's really just a matter of looking at it and watching it dissolve, because if we can look at it without condemnation or judgment, then our investment in our identity starts to go away. And the reason that we can afford to do that is because our investment in what we really are, just as one identity is ramping down, the investment in what we really are that's revealed to us as we do this begins to take hold. And a lot of that has to do with the relationship, the shared interest that I think is what Ken brilliantly points out in his Journey Through the Manual. Talks about, you know, we need to trust the Holy Spirit, which is this, you know, last paragraph talks about, it's not something we can do on our own. We need to call upon the big guns in our mind, so to speak, the higher awareness that we all took with us into the dream. And we need to remember that the shared interest, that going beyond our personal interest, and seeing everyone as our savior and wanting to help all parts of our mind that are symbolically represented as people and things outside of ourselves, is really part of that undoing process, and two vital important parts of that. So
exactly. And it isn't when you begin to recognize that what you are seeing, the brother that you, like, I'm here talking to you, what is it that I'm seeing about Bruce? It's everything that's in my mind about Bruce. Mm-hmm. It's not what's everything that's in your mind about Bruce, I can tell you that. You know, I don't know that. All I know is what's in my mind about Bruce. And what is in my mind about Bruce? It is a series of judgments. You know, when you say judgment, it doesn't mean that I'm thinking you're bad. It's a series of judgments. Bruce is a man. Bruce is this tall. Bruce has gray hair. I saw pictures of Bruce when he was younger and he didn't have gray hair. You know, I these are the things I know about Bruce. Bruce is my friend who comes here and shares this incredible wisdom with me every week, who has been a friend I could go to when I needed some help with some things, that was always willing and joyful in that. You know, that's what I know about Bruce, but that's it. It's all, and what is it that I know? It's what I know about myself. It's what I know about me. You know, I know that I love Bruce. I know that I enjoy Bruce's presence. I know that I love Bruce's clever and corny jokes. You know, these are the things that I know about Bruce. And so, you know, that's all in my mind. It's my thoughts. And those are actually judgments, because that's not Bruce at all. As much as I love it and as sweet as it is, that's really not what you are at all. Those are the facade that stands between me and truly knowing you. And they're not bad. They're not something I would throw away. In fact, it's nothing I would say. I just accept it, just as Gary just said here. You just accept it. And you know, don't judge it. Don't feel guilty because... All right.
Reconnection number umpteen successfully. I wonder if it has to do with if I'm not talking for a while, if maybe it doesn't seem to be dropping out when I'm talking, but I don't know. Whatever. Oh, well, maybe it's a.
What are you trying to say?
Anyway, actually, what I was about to say was something that reminded me of what you just said, which was excellent. This could be a John Denver song reality in his song about Toledo, Ohio. He says Saturday nights in Toledo, Ohio is like being nowhere at all. Well, maybe that's just the reality that we're in is really like being nowhere at all because in truth, you know, the dream that we're learning to replace with reality, we don't have to replace it because it's already there. You just have to get, you know, look at our dream and say, I'm not so interested in that anymore. And anyway, but do go on. do you want to read the next paragraph? Should I read the next paragraph?
Sure, I'll read the next paragraph. Let's see. Okay. Okay. No, I just.
Well, it starts with, there are people who will teach you.
Okay. Yeah, when I click this, sometimes it flips back and forth.
Sure.
So thank you. There are people who will teach you that you should, quote, make friends with your ego, unquote. That's what I was just blathering on about. But I've got news for them. The ego is not interested in being your friend. Your ego wants to kill you. Because if you can be hurt or killed, then you're a body. And if you're a body, then the entire ego thought system of separation is true. The only thing you can really do with your ego is undo it. A Course in Miracles is about undoing the ego, or the false you that has come to identify itself with the body and separation. But the real you has nothing to do with body or separation. As the Course says many times, I am not a body, I am free, for I am still as God created me. And God created you to be exactly like God. All right.
Back again.
And God created you to be exactly like God, the same as its source forever, completely and eternally in a state of oneness.
Yes. Despite the appearances of technology otherwise, where there seems to be a lot of interruptions in our connectedness, but
it's perfect.
How could perfect oneness have any technical difficulties, right?
Exactly. I mean,
so this is another example that
the world is separation.
Yeah. This is just another example of how everything in this world is part of the dream and part of our forgiveness classroom.
Yep. Exactly.
Shall I read the next paragraph?
And wanting to interrupt communication.
Exactly. Indeed.
Go ahead, yes.
Okay. The seemingly separate existence is actually a dream. The teaching that the world and the universe are an illusion is thousands of years old. But the Course refines that teaching into the idea that this world is a dream you will awaken from. And it's that awakening that is enlightenment. This is what Buddha meant when he said, I am awake. Today, most spiritual students think that when Buddha said, I am awake, in quotes, he meant he felt amazingly alert and ready to manifest like hell. And I know Gary's used that phrase in a number of the talks he's given over the last few years, which is kind of funny, you know, because he's sort of, you know, lampooning kind of the New Age dilution distortion of, you know, so many metaphysical truths. But, you know, that's true of any teaching that has truth. The ego is that we all, you know, are undoing, will try to distort everything because it resists that the true awareness. Huh?
And there are, of course, some miracle students who believe in the what do they call it, manifestation and the law of attraction.
Right.
There are, of course, some miracle students who believe that. And how can you believe that when you understand the metaphysics of the Course says nothing is happening here?
And I did for a number of years, too. I mean, I was in that league, and I thought, well, you know, there was always kind of a big question mark of like, well, why, you know, I wasn't examining why I would need to have to manifest, you know, all the things to make the world better, because obviously it wasn't working very well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's part of our classroom, isn't it? To realize that, you know, even if you have everything that, you know, in our culture and society constitutes, quote, having it made, unquote, you know, there's always something missing because just the fact that there is the rest of the universe, just if you think of yourself as being different from the rest of the universe, there obviously is always going to be something else missing, even within the dream of physicality, right?
Exactly. And if you were able to, like, reach into some other part of a dimension, some other part of the script in the dream, like somebody reaches in through your kitchen window and steals your apple pie that's sitting on the ledge. You know, I mean, you can't, you know, this interchanging of things between or manifesting things in the thing that you're already manifesting. It's like, I'm already doing this, you know, I haven't done anything different. And also, if the script is written, then what would be the point of trying to rearrange it here at this point? You know, the point is to learn the lessons and move on. You know, not to play with the pick up your pencils and your notebook and start, you know, drawing pictures. You know, learn your lesson. Anyway, go on.
I'll finish the paragraph since it looks like we're almost out of time here.
Okay.
Anyway, says, I'll just read the last sentence again. Today, most spiritual students think that when Buddha said, "I am awake," he meant he felt amazingly alert and ready to manifest like hell. Indeed, that's what passes for enlightenment in most of today's spirituality. But Buddha didn't mean he was more awake in the dream. He meant that he had awakened from the dream. And that's not just a minor distinction. It's everything. Buddha realized that he was not the dream, but the dreamer. He was not actually in the dream at all. The dream was coming from him, and he was not an effect of it, but the cause of it. And I'll just put a little brief plug at the end here that this ties into the change that I made in the subtitle of my second book, and which had a phrase of forgiving the dream of separation. Then I realized, wait a minute, no. The really important thing is forgiving the dreamer of separation. So my geometry code book subtitle was changed kind of mid-process when I realized that forgiving the dream is all well and good, but it doesn't really do much unless we forgive the dreamer of separation, which is really forgiving the decision-making faculty in our mind. So, and just as a little fun thing, that my other book, the Sacred Geometry Design Sourcebook, which you can also find on geometrycode.com, is coming up this next week on its 20th anniversary since it's been in print, which is kind of fun. So for anybody who's interested in sacred geometry, which is again part of the dream, but we can use the symbols, as I point out in the second book, for any purpose, just as we can use anything that's magic in the dream, as a reminder to, support the thought system of inclusion or exclusion. And it's all up to us as to what we choose, huh?
Exactly. So. Because it's all here for our good. It's all here to show us the contents of our mind.
Exactly.
And that's really the only purpose of it, is to show us the contents of our mind so that we can decide, you know, whether we want to stay in the dream or not. And, you know, if we're the dreamer, we can make that decision. So, and when you realize you're dreaming, I guess you have a choice. People do lucid dreaming. I guess you have a choice to stay dreaming and play in the dream. I don't know. I haven't had that experience. But, you know, for me, if I realize I'm dreaming, I'm waking up.
Uh-huh.
Wait a minute. This ain't real. You know. and it happens every time. So, anyway, thank you so much, Bruce.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, you can find me on geometrycode.com, as I mentioned a moment ago, and ACIMblog.com, which is the course-related website of the several I have. And I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving weekend, what's left of it, and love to all, and we'll see you next week. So, thanks,
all right.
Lynn.
Thank you again, Bruce Rawls. And Bruce has a website, ACIMblog.com, and it is excellent and has much, much, much content. Now, I'm just blown away by all the stuff that you have on your website.
And if people haven't picked up Gary, thank you for that. I was going to say, if people haven't picked up a copy of Gary's book, you can do that from acimblog.com. There's an interview I did with Gary and Cindy about both of their recent books on there, as well as links to Course in Miracles and Gary's books. And I just want to, you know, thank people who use those links, because it does support us financially through the Amazon affiliate program. And we get a little bit of affiliate commission from those using those links, and it's cost whoever uses them the exact same amount, whether you buy a book or a Kindle from there or from anywhere else. In other words, if you just go directly to Amazon, if you use those links, it's the same cost. So anyway, that's. But we do get a little affiliate income from those, and we appreciate that support. So anyway.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Well, I remember that myself because, you know, I just go to Amazon, so I have to keep my eyes out and see what all is going on in the Bruce world with everything. All right.
Yeah, and I'm just one last thing. We had a thing called an A store, which is an Amazon system where you can put all your favorite books. And so I had hundreds of course books that now aren't on there properly, but I'm going to put them back on there because I've managed to grab all those links. So there's a lot of wonderful course books that a lot of people may not know about that I'm going to put back on ACIM blog. But for now, you can certainly get copies of the course and Gary's books and things like that from using the link that's on.
Outstanding, and you are just a plethora of goodness. All right, well, thanks
Lynn. Thanks all. Have a great week, everyone.
I'll talk to you next week, buddy. Love you.
Likewise. Bye for now.